And I'm very pleased to say we can welcome our first guest this morning on 105.9 Bishop FM. And we say good morning to the Reverend Linda Dodds.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. Welcome to Bishop FM.
Good morning, and thank you for welcoming onto your programme. It's nice to be here.
It's an absolute pleasure. I have read the book, Blind Courage. And the book was fascinating, and it took me on a roller coaster ride of your father's life, and indeed your life.
Yes.
Partway through the book, you arrive. But let's start at the beginning. Let's go to Hartlepool, shall we?
Yes, my father was David Ronald Johnston, known as Ron in the family. He was born in Hartlepool in the 1920s. His father worked in the shipyards there. He was what was known as a ship's plater, a skill sadly lost now, I think, to computers. But yes, he was born in just beside the harbour in Hartlepool, and began his life there. And he was born with a normal child, full and normal sight.
Yeah.
No problems at all until he started school.
Mm.
And in starting school in those days, it was the beginning of concerns for children's dental health.
Yeah.
Dental health was not particularly good at that time following the war years, and he attended a clinic when he started school and was told, his mum was told, he needed to have a tooth removed.
Mm.
Simple procedure.
Indeed.
Yep.
Straightforward, no complications.
Yeah, presumably a milk tooth.
Mm.
Although it's only in researching the book that I've realised that it probably was just a milk tooth.
Mm.
And perhaps may not necessarily have needed been removing, but that's what happened. And unfortunately, things didn't go straightforwardly. There were complications. My father's mouth and eyes bled excessively, to the point for 5 days, actually. And the result of that was that his optic nerve was damaged and his sight was lost.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yes, and of course, what ensued then was something of a quest to bring your father as a young boy up to a point where he could be, I suppose, really looking forward, independent and lead an independent existence. But that meant, didn't it, at some point, him having to move away from family?
Absolutely. It was felt in those days, in the 1920s, that it was best for children with disabilities, and particularly for children with sight loss, to be removed from their families and to be placed into effectively boarding schools. The purpose of that was to make them independent, as you rightly said. And in my father's case, that was successful. He was an extremely independent person. But I realised, in retrospect, that was at a great cost to his family.
Mm.
Yeah, he initially went to Benwell in Newcastle to a primary school there. He won a scholarship from there to London, to the School for the Blind in London. So I think he would be about 11 when he went there.
Having to go to London,
yes,
and live away
from his family
at 11 years of age.
Yeah. And I looked at I got the logbooks and managed to look at some of those. And it's been really, the visiting and the rules were really strict.
Mm.
Weekend visiting only, no younger children. So my father had younger siblings, they weren't allowed to visit. No visiting on a Sunday, and if you wanted to go on a different day, you had to make an appointment. And really strict visiting. So a real difficult for his family.
Mm.
Yeah, but.
And of course, it a move then to another centre for the blind, and of course. At some point, the Second World War.
Well, the Second World War
comes
intervened.
Along.
Yes, and it wasn't deemed safe for the school to be in London, so they moved initially to Kent, to a house in Kent, and quite successfully settled there till about the fall of France, and Kent became front line. The skies of Kent became front line for the war, so they had to evacuate again. And this time they went to Shrewsbury, to just outside of Shrewsbury, to a place called Rowton Castle. And the rest of the war, they remained there. I think they actually purchased that building and remained there for quite some time. So his school life was quite various places. He travelled around a bit. It was quite disrupted, but he thrived in college and in school. Yeah.
Now we have many gaps to fill, but this story does move to Bishop Auckland, West Auckland, South Church even.
That's right.
Yes.
Yes.
But how we get there, we will go on to discover as we talk to the Reverend Linda Dodds, who's written a book called Blind Courage. And it's all about her father and the wonderful things that her father achieved over the course of his lifetime. And you chose Elton John.
I did.
You did.
Yes, I'm a good Elty fan.
Yeah, from the 1970s.
Absolutely.
Yes. So it's your song, it's your book, your story. So where does the story take us next, Linda?
Well, unfortunately, while my father was at college in Shrewsbury, in 1940, his father died very suddenly of a heart attack while working in Gray's Shipyard in Hartlepool. Leaving his mum and his sister, two sisters and brothers, at home there in Hartlepool. So that was a very difficult time for himself, obviously away from the family and country under threat of invasion. Hartlepool was at the front line of things. It had been attacked in the First World War, so there was a worry that it would be attacked again this time. You know, so very worrying time. For him and his wife. And he was only 16, of course, at that point. Mm-hmm. Sort of within the tragedy that was unfolding for the country, a personal tragedy within the family as well. And his father was only 51, 52 years old when he died.
So that meant a journey back home? And
I would imagine so, yes. Yeah. But you know, he continued his studies. He continued at college and eventually qualified as an award-winning shorthand typist. He studied quite a lot of things, obviously, at college, but he qualified as a shorthand typist and a very good one.
He won
a silver medal and lots of competitions and things. He did actually challenge, when he left college, he did challenge... put out a countrywide challenge to any sighted typist, shorthand typist, to have a little competition between them to see who was best. You know, this was all part of his desire to show that people with sight loss were at no disadvantage in the workplace. You know, that they had a contribution to make to the workplace, to the society, to the economy. So he challenged. Put out this challenge, and the result was that they had this competition, and it was found there was no difference at all between the work of my father and the sighted typist. The judge did say the only difference was that the blind shorthand typist, they couldn't rub out any mistakes that they made. But they got round this by not making any mistakes in the first place.
Don't make any mistakes. You don't need to rub them out.
Absolutely. Yeah. He was a perfectionist in everything that he did.
And that was a sign, of course, of his courage and determination, wasn't
absolutely.
It?
Absolutely.
Shining through even then.
Yeah. From a very young age, he was determined that he would fight against the society's perceptions of blind people, that people should not be at a disadvantage simply because they couldn't see, that their worth and their contribution to society was just as much as anyone else. They just couldn't see.
Well, let's talk about your father's early employment now, because obviously qualifications wonderful to have, but you need to put them to good use. So
that's right.
What was the first thing your father managed to get a job?
He worked for many years, Gary, in London, and I didn't realise this Yeah, this is something that I've discovered whilst researching the book. And I spoke to his sister, who he has one sister who's still alive, and I spoke to her about this, and she said that Madad had spent many years in London. About 20 years, I think, he worked around London and various places as a shorthand typist, and lived alone in London. And he... at this time refused any aid. He wouldn't have a white stick. I never remember my father having a white stick or referring to having a white stick, and he certainly wouldn't have a guide dog, but he also wouldn't allow people to link arms with him. And he developed a sort of a system where he would walk alongside someone with his shoulder just behind theirs, just to say touching, and would be guided in that way. But he lived in London on his own, found his way around completely unaided, which I, when I think about it, I think is absolutely wonderful, but scares me as well at the thought of him doing that.
Arriving in London as a sighted person. Goodness.
Finding his way around the underground system and the busy streets and completely unaided. Yeah. And by memory. He committed everything to memory. He actually, the family were worried about him, and my uncle was sent down on a mission to find out, make sure he was okay. And was absolutely amazed that my father actually took him on a guided tour of London and showed him the way around and where everything was, and completely at home.
Another sign of the determination in the soul. Right, okay, we'll take another piece of music that you have chosen, and again, it's from the 1970s, which must have been an important decade for you.
Well, yes, I'm stuck there, I'm afraid.
Okay, then, so we are in conversation with Reverend Linda Dodds, who's talking about her book, Blind Courage, which I would strongly encourage you to go out and find a copy of and read. Order it from anywhere you like. Just read it. It is fascinating. And if you have any memories at all of the way Bishop used to be in years gone by, then it's all covered in this book. Because I suppose now, Linda, we're heading towards a point in your father's life where he moves here, right where we are now.
He did. He came back to the northeast, not to Hartlepool, but to St Helens, Auckland.
Mm-hmm.
He came back initially to take up the position of a telephonist at West Tool, which was one of the factories on the trading estate in St Helens at that time. He worked there for some time, but he wanted obviously to use the skills that he'd attained at college in shorthand and typing, so he applied for and got the post of personal assistant to Leo Lewin, who was at the clothing factory and also in St Helens. That came with a key worker's house, and so he moved his family from Hartlepool to St Helens, and they moved in there to a house on Simpson Avenue. Well, initially I tell a lie, Dalton Avenue.
On Dalton Avenue.
Yeah, and then into Simpson Avenue. Yeah. And he whilst typically of himself, he engrossed himself in the community. He had a tremendous social conscience and a tremendous sense of community and being in community and communities working together for the common good. So he became a councillor on what was then the Bishop Auckland Urban District Council, long gone. Used to meet in the town hall.
Mm.
He represented the St Helens ward for a couple of sessions on that, and did lots of just your community work in that sense. He worked with lots of charities, guide dogs in particular, lots of work for guide dogs and local. But he also set up the St Helens and Tyndall Community Association with the view of building a community centre in St Helens for the people of St Helens and Tyndall Crescent. And in the midst of that, I came along, and we were, I remember as a child, we were raising money in all sorts of ways to build the community centre, to coffee mornings and raffles and all sorts of things. Wonderful stuff.
Yeah. And of course, your father meets your mother on the doorstep.
Oh, yes.
And
yeah, well, we've skipped ahead a little bit. Yes, whilst living in St. Helens, obviously, my mum and her family had settled in West Auckland, and my mum worked for the Newcastle, London and Newcastle Tea Company, which was also in Bishop Auckland in Newgate Street. And part of her job was to go around the doors collecting orders. And one of her customers was my grandma, my father's mum. She would come each week and chat on the doorstep. And apparently my dad heard her talking to his mum one day and liked the sound of her voice, so contrived to answer the door when she came the following week, and then the following week, and the following week. And he always loved to say that he fell in love with her voice, which is quite nice, romantic way to meet. Nice story.
Oh, yes, yeah. Indeed. Yes, indeed. Mm. Still a reluctance to use a guide dog?
Yeah. No guide dog. That didn't happen till I was born. I was the instigator of that. Obviously, when I came along, the extra responsibilities for my mum meant that pressure from the family was placed on my dad to get a guide dog at that point. So that was when he got a guide dog for the first time, yeah.
Yeah, and gradually as you're growing up, you are able to identify ways in which you can help your father. And
well, yes, I mean, that became sort of gradual from quite a young age. I would help him in various things, reading letters, reading reports, help him cross the road and all these things from a very, very young age. Yeah, this was all just part of how it was.
Yeah.
Normal to me.
Normal to you, absolutely. Yes, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. So we are now in St. Helen, Auckland, and a community centre is established.
Yes, that was built. And yeah, it was to my father's design. I remember sitting with my mum on the floor in the house in St. Helens with a Lego set and planning out with Lego the design of this building for my father, so he could then feel the shape and check that it was right. So the community centre at St. Helens was designed by Lego. Or in Lego. I don't know how many buildings have been designed like that. But, he wanted... Again, that was typical of my father. You know, he wanted to be involved. He wanted it to be exactly. And he wanted to be able to feel exactly how it was and how he wanted it. And that was the only way we could do that.
Yeah. I think that aspect of your father's nature, I think, shines through. It's this determination to want things the way he likes them, because then he understands how it all works and he feels in control. Yes. And on top of the situation.
Absolutely, yeah.
Not the other way around.
Yeah, he had this ability to internally visualize everything, how he wanted it, as you say, what the outcome would be, how things would be, and very much hands-on and very much involved in that, and very much, as I said earlier, a perfectionist.
Yeah.
Everything had to be absolutely right.
So, Linda, we are now at the point where your father is well established in the in community work and a local councillor in the St. Helen, Auckland area. So where does the story take us next?
Well, in the early 60s, he applied for the position of Northern Regional Organiser for Oxfam. There were apparently 500 applicants for that post. And he was the successful applicant for that. And his remit, I suppose, was to establish and make Oxfam known in the north of England. Mm-hmm. It wasn't at that time. It was really quite a small charity at that time, based in Oxford, originally known as the Oxford Committee for Famine Relief. It had been set up post-war to help refugees in Greece, but not really well known in the north of England. So his job was to establish committees throughout a huge area, from the borders down to almost to Hull, right across into what was Cumberland and Westmorland in those days.
It's a huge area.
A massive area.
Yeah, yeah.
But setting up committees, setting up... And then eventually shops. That was one of the main things, to set up Oxfam shops and committees to run them across that area. And that was where I sort of started come into helping him to do that. You know, I have memories of going, because he had to go everywhere on the bus, you know, and we used to travel the length and breadth of the...
Over to Cumberland on the bus.
On the bus, you know, I don't know how we did that, to be honest. obviously, there were more buses in those days. But going along with him and to these meetings and being his eyes... initially, telling me who was there, you know, how many people were in the room, where the windows and the doors were, and who was speaking, you know, with the dog asleep under the table.
And at some point, you were his secretary as well.
Lots of reading of letters and lots of folding of leaflets when he was running campaigns. Used to send out, you know, everything was sort of manual in those days, no computers then, and emails and things. Lots of leaflets to fold and put into envelopes and send out. But my father would, I would read letters to him, and he would make shorthand notes with his special Braille shorthand machine, and then he would use his typewriter to type them. So lots of Saturday mornings doing that, and but great times, yeah.
And Oxfam, by the time I think by the time you moved to South Church, I think Oxfam is it fairly well established.
We moved to South Church the beginning of the 70s. My father was then made Northern Director of Oxfam, which was quite a high position for him to hold. And that involved him travelling to Oxford monthly on the train with the dog, to London for conferences, to, you know, all over the country then. And yes, Oxfam was becoming much more wild, you know. Previous to that, my father was very much involved in campaigns for famines and... throughout the 70s, 60s and 70s, very much raising the profile, very much hands-on in getting people involved. He had a tremendous capacity to take people along with him, to get him involved with, you know, what he was doing. And, you know, you couldn't meet my father and not become involved in what he was doing. He had a huge enthusiasm and a huge ability to enable other people and inspire other people to get involved, and I've learned that lots of people have got in touch with me, you know, who he did that to, you know, who were inspired by him and who he encouraged and who went on to do great things in their own lives, which has been wonderful to hear about. But Oxfam became it was his life. He was totally dedicated to the work of Oxfam. I particularly spend a little bit of time in the book talking about the campaign he ran in this part, the north of England, during the Biafra war. Many people remember that.
Indeed.
It was the first time that starving children were seen on our television screens.
That's right.
Quite shocking. And my father was 100% involved in raising money for that campaign, and he got churches and schools and everybody involved in, as he put it, you know, get the whole town involved in raising money for the children of Biafra. That was a campaign I particularly remember him being involved in.
And of course, you who are listening to this right now might well have been one of those people who were inspired. By Mr. Johnson.
Yeah, that's possible, yes.
So Oxfam is becoming established, and your father finally does team up with a guide dog. In fact, a succession of guide dogs. It's about two or three.
Four in total, yeah, yes. Yeah. All very much characters in their own right. Very different sorts of dogs. One thing I have sort of discovered whilst researching for this book, as people remember my father, and most people have a little story to tell about it, most people also have a story to tell about one of the dogs.
Mm.
I'm wondering, you know, if I did, perhaps could do a sequel on the stories of the dogs. Because everybody seems to remember the dogs. But yes, he had four in total. Initially a Collie Cross, Alsatian Cross, which is unusual. Guide dogs tend to be just mainly Labradors, Retrievers these days. But in the early days, used lots of breeds. So we initially that was Trixie, who sadly turned out to be too small for my dad and had to go back and retrain to be with a lady owner. He then had a boxer dog called Major, who was a real character.
With his little fang.
With his little, one of his tooth, his fangs, as you were, used to stick out over the top of his lip, make him look rather fierce, but he wasn't at all fierce. He was lovely, a very intelligent dog. And then two Labradors, a very large and lovable yellow one called Shona, and then his last dog was a black Labrador called Dusky. Who had several adventures that are noted in the book. She was very much a character. The dogs gave my dad even more independence and freedom. He had a lot of travelling to do, obviously, with his job, and they enabled him to go off and travel on his own. He would travel on the trains to London and to Oxford once a month. Became well known on them, well known by the railway staff. Lots of fond memories of the dogs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And of course, the community work moves along with your father too. Is it Rosemont?
Rosemont Road in South Church.
We
moved to, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That was the first house my parents owned. And that was really quite significant for them. Yeah.
That was a bit larger than.
Yes.
Than the one you had left. Yeah. And then there's a lovely part in the book where I can vividly imagine the scene where your father thinks, oh, well, the best place to go is possibly the Working Men's Club.
Yes.
We'll just pop down there and we'll say hello to a few folk. And
that's right.
Would you just share that with our listener, please?
Dad had this huge sense of community and of being involved in the community. And obviously we were a huge part of the community at St. Helens. So when we moved to South Church, he equally wanted to become involved in that community. And as you say, he decided that perhaps the place to begin was the Working Men's Club. I was less than convinced about that, but we I found myself walking down the bank from our house down the bank and over the bridge over the Gonless, linking my father one Friday night. And I can remember it vividly. We got to the club and I opened the door and it was full of smoke, as it was in those days. And,
yes.
Full of men only, all with pints in their hands, you know. And the effect was absolutely instant. Just total silence. The place just fell into silence. And I navigated my father through the people to the bar, and he was, you know, his usual jovial self, you know, pint of your best ale, barman, please, sort of thing. And all eyes were on us, and I just wanted the ground to open up and swallow me.
Yeah.
You know, and we had 10 minutes of this where, you know, my father chatted to the barman, and just this silence of people around us, bewilderment, I think, of this blind man in his suit and his shirt and tie, and a young girl at his side. I don't know what they thought or why we were there. Or I would love to have heard their comments when eventually my father, after half an hour, my father decided we'd done enough integrating for one night and and we could leave, thankfully.
Yeah.
I don't know whether anybody would remember that occasion, but it stuck in my mind. And I would love to have heard their comments when we left as to what they made of us. Well, my father, unfortunately, suffered, as a result of pressures of work and things, he did suffer a breakdown. And sadly, he died at the very young age of just short of his 52nd birthday, of a very severe heart attack. obviously, in the outdoors, as his father had, just in the lane across from our house, while walking with Dusky and my mum. And we haven't had time to talk about my mum, but she was a huge part of this story as well.
Well,
but
you know the answer people to that, will
read,
don't you?
Just to read the book.
They've got to read the book.
Yes.
I highly recommend it. In the last few seconds, where can we get our hands on a copy of this?
Anywhere, you're obviously, am I allowed to say Amazon?
Of course you are.
Okay, yes. You can order it from Amazon or any online bookseller or any of the major booksellers. It's available. £10. Bargain.
It's called Blind Courage, and it is by the Reverend Linda Dodds, whom you may well know. And we thank enormously for coming in. Thank you very much indeed, Linda.
Thank you so much, Gary. Thank you.
It's been fascinating.
Thank you very much.